which was modeled after the Strozzi Palace of Florence, lies a three-level vault built into the bedrock of Manhattan, 50 feet under sea level. It holds more than $60 billion of gold, real hard assets with real value. If Lehman's fate was going to be resolved, if Wall Street was going to be saved, the matter would be decided at 33 Liberty Street. While modern finance may have allowed investors to zip money across continents in milliseconds, the New York Federal Reserve stood as one of the last bastions of tangible values. As John Thayne's black GMC Yukon pulled up to the building, he couldn't help but recall the last time he had come there, as a partner at Goldman, in response to another such cataclysmic event, the rescue of Long-Term Capital Management in 1998. For 3 straight days, he had worked around the clock to come up with a solution. And had they not saved Long-Term Capital, the next domino back in 1998 was clearly Lehman Brothers, which was suffering from a similar crisis of confidence. The irony of the situation was rich. 10 years earlier, on a Saturday morning just past 7:30 a.m., Thayne had run into Fold in the Fed hallways and asked, "How's it going?" "Not so well," Fold had said. "People are spreading nasty rumors." "I can't imagine that," Thayne had replied, trying to be polite, but knowing full well that the rumors were everywhere. "When I find out who it is," Fold had said ferociously, "I'm going to reach down his throat and tear out his heart." They were back to where they started. The meeting of the families did not begin until 6:45 p.m. when Paulson, Geithner, and Cox finally emerged, briskly walking down a long hall on the first floor, almost as if they were marching in a formation toward a conference room in the south corner of the building overlooking Liberty and Williams Streets. The CEOs had all been milling about, tapping away on their Blackberries, and pouring themselves cups of ice water to cool themselves from the miasma of humidity that hung in the building. If there had been any question about the subject of this gathering, it was readily apparent before Paulson ever said a word. Conspicuous by his absence was the longest-running member of their tribe, Dick Fold. "Thanks for coming down here on such short notice," Paulson began. He explained that Lehman Brothers was in a precarious position and told the group, "We're going to need to find a solution before the weekend is out." And then, to make it perfectly clear what the parameters of that solution were going to be, he stated flatly, "It's not going to be government money. You're going to have to figure this out." "We've got 2 buyers that are each going to need help, in my judgment," he continued. He did not mention Bank of America or Barclays by name, but everyone knew who the players were. The names had crossed the tape 24 hours earlier. He revealed to the men arrayed around the table that each bidder had already indicated to him that it would not buy Lehman Brothers unless the government, or someone, consented to finance at least part of the deal. "There's no consensus for the government to get involved. There is no will to do this in Congress," he said, stammering and stuttering at one point about how Nancy Pelosi had been all over him about bailouts. "You will need to come up with a private market solution. You have a responsibility to the marketplace. I know it's unpleasant to help a competitor do a deal, but it's not going to be as unpleasant as it will be if Lehman goes," Paulson stressed. "You need to do this." For many in the room, the idea of coming to the assistance of a rival was more than unpleasant. It was anathema. What made the situation even worse was that the competitors they were being asked to aid were Bank of America and Barclays, the ultimate outsiders. Ken Lewis, Bank of America's CEO, had disparaged them every chance he got, and they all viewed Barclays as a wannabe, a second-tier player trying to break into the big leagues. How was helping these firms going to do anything other than hurt everyone assembled in the room? Lehman wasn't attracting much sympathy either. "Dick is in no condition to make any decisions," Paulson announced with a tinge of derision, explaining why Fold wasn't present. "He is in denial," Paulson continued, before calling him distant and dysfunctional. It was now Geithner's turn to speak. As one of his assistants passed around copies of a document charting Lehman Brothers' balances, he said sternly, "If you don't find a solution, it's only going to make the situation worse for everybody here." The problem was evident. Lehman had virtually no cash left. If there was no solution by Monday, The risk was that investors would demand what little money was left and put the firm out of business within minutes of the opening bell. That, in turn, would put the financial system as a whole at risk, as counterparties, investors on the other side of a trade with Lehman, wouldn't be able to settle their trades, creating a cascading problem that could soon turn into a catastrophe. As sophisticated as the world's markets have become, the glue that holds the entire arrangement together remains old-fashioned trust. Once that vanishes, things can unravel very quickly. Both Blankfein and Diamond countered that they believed that the risk inherent in a Lehman bankruptcy was being overstated, at least from their respective firms' points of view. They had already told Paulson privately that they had reduced most of their risks to Lehman Brothers, and Blankfein didn't mind now bringing that fact up in front of the group. "We've all seen this coming from miles," he told the room. Geithner, taking their opinions in without responding, instructed the bankers to break up into three working groups. The first would value Lehman's toxic assets, the portion of the business that it had announced it would spin off into the company called SpinCo. The bankers in the room quickly renamed it ShitCo, offering a bit of much-needed comic relief. The second group, Geithner continued, would look at developing a structure for the banks to invest in Lehman. And finally, there was what he had described in private meetings earlier that day as the lights-out scenario. If Lehman was forced to file for bankruptcy, he wanted all the banks that traded with it to see if they could contain the damage in advance by trading around Lehman to net down their positions. In case there was any confusion, Geithner reiterated Paulson's decree. There is no political will for a federal bailout. As he spoke those words, a subway train passed underneath the room, rumbling ominously, as if to underscore his point. Christopher Cox, as impeccably dressed and coiffed as ever, made a brief statement, telling everyone in the room that they were great Americans, and impressing upon them the patriotic duty they were undertaking. Most of the bankers in the room rolled their eyes at the sentiment, as they regarded Cox as a lightweight, and would later describe him as cryogenically frozen. The conversation quickly turned to both the philosophical and the practical as the bankers talked over one another. "I assume we are going to talk about AIG," Vikram Pandit of Citigroup asked, as the room grew quiet. Geithner shot him a harsh look. "Let's focus on Lehman," he said firmly, trying to avoid losing control of the meeting. "You can't deal with Lehman in isolation," Pandit persisted. "We can't find ourselves back here next weekend." Diamond jumped in. "We're there at AIG. Our team is there," he said, explaining that J.P. Morgan was advising the insurer and suggesting that they were working to find a solution. "You know, Jamie," Pandit replied brusquely, "we've got a team there too, and I don't think it's as under control as you think." Pandit and Diamond continued to trade barbs, and the mounting tension began to remind many in the room of a conference call that Geithner had coordinated among the big bank CEOs the night that J.P. Morgan acquired Bear Stearns. "Stop being such a jerk," Diamond had yelled at Pandit then, when he questioned him about Citi's exposure to Bear, now that he had bought the firm. Geithner insisted that the Fed had AIG under control, and again attempted to move the conversation along. What remained unacknowledged was that J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, as advisors to AIG, were the only parties in the room that had any true appreciation for the depth of the problems that the firm faced. Thane, whose bank was likely the next to fall, as everyone in the room understood all too well, remained notably silent during the exchanges. Before ordering the room full of bankers to get their teams together and be back at the Fed by 9 o'clock the next morning, Paulson made one last pitch that to many in the room sounded more like a threat. "This is about our capital markets, our country. We will remember anyone who is not seen as helpful." The room emptied as the bankers left expressionless and mute, dumbstruck at the magnitude of the work that lay before them. John Mack pulled out his cell phone the moment he left the New York Fed building to report back to the office. "Guys, it's going to be a long night," he told his lieutenants, James Gorman, Waleed Chamal, and Paul Taubman, and ordered them to prepare for Lehman to go under. "We're going to need lots of bodies this weekend. The Morgan Stanley bankers had two related tasks, self-preservation and helping the Fed. They'd once again have to review the extent of their exposure to Lehman, looking through their derivatives book and also examining their clients' exposures to Lehman. Investment banking, meanwhile, should start looking through Lehman's client list to see whom they could pick off. A board call would have to be arranged to keep everyone updated. Another team would have to run numbers on Lehman's asset values. They would finally get a chance to see Lehman's finances. If nothing else, it could prove to be an interesting education. Mac directed his driver to his favorite Italian restaurant, San Pietro, to pick up some food for the team, who would need to be fortified for the sleepless night they all faced. Everyone would have to start acting like a first-year analyst. Upon leaving the meeting, John Thane, who had been joined at the meeting by his colleague, Peter Krause, immediately phoned Peter Kelly, the firm's deal lawyer, and told him to be at the Fed on Saturday. He followed up with a call to Greg Fleming as his Yukon made its way up the Merritt Parkway. He had planned to have dinner with his wife and two friends and was already an hour late. "It's a food fight down here," Thane told Fleming. "It looks like Lehman isn't getting saved." As he related, with surprise, how Paulson had refused to offer any government help, he knew how Fleming was going to respond. "We have to start thinking about ourselves. We have to think about our options," Fleming said. "Really, John, we're going to run out of time." Thane, still noncommittal, said only, "Let's go get some sleep, and we'll talk in the morning." When Thane finally arrived for his dinner engagement at Rebecca's restaurant in Greenwich, he saw Steve Black of J.P. Morgan, who had been on his cell phone for the past half hour with the firm's management team, standing out front, still talking. As it happened, he was in the middle of a conversation speculating about what might happen to Merrill Lynch. Black, who was aghast to see Thane, "His company is next. What's he doing here?" nonchalantly greeted him with, "Great minds think alike." "Yeah, but I was supposed to meet another couple and my wife, and they've been sitting here for the last 2 hours," Thane replied. "At least I called," Black said with a laugh. As Thane went inside, Black returned to the conference call. "You're never going to believe who I just ran into." At Lehman's headquarters, a stunned and livid Dick Fuld had just gotten off the phone with Bart McDade, who had the unenviable task of informing the CEO that a meeting had been held down at the Fed about his company, and that he hadn't been invited. Rajan Cohen had been notified by the Fed to instruct McDade to bring a team down to the Fed on Saturday morning, and had explicitly warned him not to bring Fuld, explaining, "The Fed doesn't want him down there." Trying to soften the blow, McDade prevaricated. He told Fuld that there would be a lot of grunt work to do downtown, and that his time would be better spent manning the office, so that he could remain in constant contact with the regulators and his CEO brethren. What he didn't relay to Fuld, of course, was that they would all be together at the Fed, in person. As he ended the call with McDade, Fuld had another reason to be furious when he realized that he hadn't heard back from Ken Lewis all day, and it was already past 9 o'clock p.m. Bank of America's diligence teams over at Sullivan and Cromwell had left hours earlier, and from what he had heard, their body language suggested they weren't leaving just for the night. "I can't believe that goddamn son of a bitch won't return my call," Fuld complained to Russo. Fuld had phoned him at least a half dozen times, sometimes not leaving a voicemail for fear of seeming desperate. He thought Lewis had practically shook his hand over the phone just 24 hours earlier. Where the hell had he gone? Enough was enough. Fuld swallowed his pride and dialed Lewis's home in Charlotte. Lewis's wife, Donna, picked up in the kitchen. "Is Ken there?" Fuld asked. "Who is it?" "Dick Fuld." There was a long pause as Linda looked over at her husband, who was sitting in the living room. When she mouthed, "Fuld is on the line," Lewis shook his finger, signaling to her to duck the call. Donna felt uncomfortable, but she had had plenty of experience in dodging unwanted callers for her husband. "You really have to stop calling," she said sympathetically to Fuld. "Ken isn't coming to the phone." Crestfallen, Fuld replied, "I'm really sorry to have bothered you." Fuld placed the phone down and put both hands on his head, So I'm the schmuck, he shouted at nobody in particular. Harvey Miller, Lehman's bankruptcy lawyer, walked into Weil Gottschall's conference room just down the hall from his office and told the associates to go home and have dinner. It was getting late, and he hadn't heard anything new from anyone at Lehman. This is just a fire drill, he thought. Lehman Brothers isn't going to have to file. Miller hopped into a cab to his apartment on Fifth Avenue. As he opened the door, his cell phone rang. James Bromley, a lawyer with Cleary Gottlieb Steen & Hamilton, which was advising the New York Fed, asked almost matter-of-factly, Harvey, are there any plans for a bankruptcy? Miller was taken aback. It's not the objective. It's not in the forecast, he replied decisively. There certainly isn't any intensive work being done on it. I'm at home. I can tell you that right now the company really believes it's going to get a deal. Are you sure? Bromley persisted. Miller related how the New York Fed had not seemed very worried during a presentation by one of his associates earlier that day. Bromley, uncertain what to make of this news, muttered, maybe we should meet again tomorrow morning, and hung up. As Miller headed into the living room, he said to his wife, Ruth, bewilderedly, I just got the strangest call. Back at AIG, Willemstad was still searching for a quick fix. He and Bronstein decided to try Warren Buffett one last time. Perhaps they could sell him some assets, anything, really, that he might want in his portfolio. Buffett had already left the office, but his assistant patched the call through to his home, the same home he had purchased in 1958 for $31,500. You said you'd be interested in assets. Anything in particular? Willemstad asked, after greeting him and explaining the purpose of his call. Buffett, reticent, offered, Well, we could be interested in the auto business. Would you be interested in taking all of the U.S. property and casualty business? Willemstad suggested. That was a major piece of the company, representing $40 billion in annual revenue. What's it worth? Buffett asked. We'd say $25 billion. You'd probably say $20 billion, Willemstad replied. What information do you need to do that? When Buffett told him to send what he could, Willemstad said, Okay, give us an hour, and we'll get a package of material together. Where can we email it? Buffett let out a long laugh and informed him that he didn't use email. Can I fax it to you? Willemstad asked. I don't have a fax machine here, Buffett said, still chuckling. Why don't you fax it to the office? I'll go get in my car and drive back down to the office and pick it up. An hour later, Buffett was back on the phone, politely rejecting the proposal. It's too big a deal. $25 billion is too big. Willemstad never thought he'd hear Buffett call any prospective deal too big. I'd have to use all my cash and can't do anything to jeopardize Berkshire's AAA rating, Buffett explained. For a moment, he alluded to the possibility of raising the money, but then acknowledged that he didn't want to have that kind of debt on my balance sheet. Okay, thanks a lot, Willemstad said. But by the way, if there's anything else in the pool that you're interested in, let us know. Merrill's Greg Fleming was tossing and turning in bed that night, so much so that his wife, Melissa, finally insisted that he tell her what was bothering him. It's Friday night and you're not sleeping, she mumbled. Wide awake, he turned to her. This is a different kind of Friday night. The next week or so in this industry is going to be epic. After nodding off briefly, Fleming finally rose at 4:30 a.m., his mind racing. He recalled his conversation of the night before with John Finnegan, his closest confidant on Merrill's board. Finnegan was clearly as anxious as Fleming about the firm's mounting problems, and they agreed they had to persuade Thane to seek a deal with Ken Lewis. You've got to push this, Greg, Finnegan urged him. There's a way to get this done. Fleming had had essentially the same conversation with Peter Kelly. You just need to get the imprimatur of John to approach Bank of America, Kelly had told him. We've got to start getting things going. If the meeting tomorrow morning doesn't go right, we have 36 hours to put a trade together. It was coming up on 6:30 on Saturday morning when Fleming finally decided it was late enough to phone Thane's home. Thane was just leaving and returned the call 5 minutes later from the back seat of his SUV. "I've been thinking about this," Fleming said resolutely. "We have to call Ken Lewis." Thane, taken aback, had spent much of the night thinking about whether such a deal made sense, and had come to the opposite conclusion, at least for the time being. Merrill might want to try to raise some money over the weekend by selling a small stake in the firm to raise market confidence, but there was no reason to sell the entire company immediately, he told Fleming. As he had always warned his troops before entering talks, once you initiate, you're in motion. Negotiations could quickly spiral beyond your control. "They are our best partner," he said dejectedly of Bank of America. "Where are we going to be if we lose them?" As his SUV barreled down the FDR drive, Thane promised to consider the issue further, but for now, he needed to focus on the meetings ahead of him. Jamie Dimon's black Lexus pulled away from the curb of his Park Avenue apartment to head down to the Fed just before 8 a.m. Dimon, who sat in the back seat returning emails on his BlackBerry, had just gotten off a conference call with his management team. He had dropped a bombshell on them, telling them to prepare for the bankruptcies of Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, AIG, Morgan Stanley, and even Goldman Sachs. He knew he might be overstating the case, but he figured they needed to be prepared. Dimon was anxious, fearful, really. He was the man who knew too much. As the clearing bank for both Lehman and Merrill, all trades for those firms passed through J.P. Morgan, he could see how quickly their businesses were crumbling. And as the advisor to AIG, well, that had been a nightmare for weeks. He probably knew more than Paulson. He just hoped he was wrong. Pacing in his kitchen, Fleming decided to try one last time to impress upon Thane that talking to Bank of America wasn't just a good plan, it was perhaps the only way to save Merrill Lynch. If Bank of America bought Lehman instead, Merrill faced an onslaught of unimaginable proportions. The math was clear. If Lehman was swallowed up, there would be a run on the next biggest broker-dealer, and that was his firm. Merrill Lynch, perhaps the most iconic investment bank in the nation, was on the brink of ruin. Thane picked up Fleming's call just as his SUV was winding down Maiden Lane and about to enter the underground parking lot of the Fed building. A half-dozen photographers had already camped out and were snapping away. "This is our time to move," Fleming insisted. "We don't even necessarily have to do the deal, but we should at least examine it now, and we should see if we can put it together." "We should use the weekend to do that," Fleming pressed on, before Thane could interrupt him. "We shouldn't try to do this potentially under duress next week." As a long-time dealmaker, Fleming certainly knew how valuable even a weekend could be. The biggest deals on Wall Street had always been finalized when the markets were closed on Saturday and Sunday, so that the details could be refined without worrying that a leak could quickly affect stock prices and potentially scuttle an agreement. Thane still counseled patience. "If Lehman doesn't make it, if they file for Chapter 11, Bank of America will still be there," he told Fleming. But he assured him, "I hear you loud and clear. I'm keeping an open mind. And if we need to make the call, we'll make the call." That was all Fleming needed to hear. He was making progress. By 8 a.m., the grand lobby of the New York Federal Reserve was teeming with bankers and lawyers. They had gathered not far from a giant bronze statue of young Sophocles, his outstretched arm holding a tortoiseshell and horn lyre. The statue was a symbol of victory after the Battle of Salamis, a clash that saved Greece and perhaps Western civilization from the East. On this day, the bankers assembled at the Fed had their own historic battle to wage, with stakes that were in some ways just as high. They were trying to save themselves from their own worst excesses and, in the process, save Western capitalism from financial catastrophe. An hour later, the group shuffled into the same boardroom at the end of the corridor where they had sat, mostly shell-shocked the night before. By morning, they had settled on the working groups. Citi, Merrill, and Morgan Stanley were put in charge of analyzing Lehman's balance sheet and liquidity issues. Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse, and Deutsche Bank were assigned to study Lehman's real estate assets and determine the size of the hole. Goldman had had a jump start as a result of its mini-diligence session earlier in the week. And both Vikram Pandit and Gary Shedlin of Citigroup were so nervous that Goldman would try to buy the assets themselves on the cheap that they attached themselves to their group. "As you know, the government's not doing this. You're on your own. Figure it out, make it happen," Geithner said. "I'm going to come back in 2 hours. You guys better figure out a solution and get this thing done." His tone struck many in the room as patronizing, if not ridiculous. "This is fucking nuts," Pandit said to John Mack. It was as if they had all been handed a test without the customary number two pencils. Lloyd Blankfein raised a question. "Tim, I understand what you want to do, but how do I get in the other room?" In other words, he wanted to know how he could become a buyer subsidized by his competitors. Blankfein wasn't serious. He had no interest in buying Lehman, but he was clearly trying to make a point. "Why are we helping our competition?" Geithner deflected the question and left the room, followed by the bankers, who were simultaneously daunted and deflated. Thane, Peter Krause, and Peter Kelly of Merrill found a corner to talk in. "So, what do you think?" Kelly asked. "Lehman's not going to make it," Thane said. "Then we're not going to make it either," Kelly replied calmly. "We have to start thinking about options," Krause said. Thane nodded in agreement. Maybe Fleming was right after all. Thane dialed Fleming, and after telling him about the conversation, said, "Set up the meeting with Lewis." Upstairs on the 7th floor of the Fed, Lehman's Bart McDade and Alex Kirk felt a little bit like mail-order brides as they waited to meet the bankers from the firms that they hoped would save them. This, they knew, would be the ultimate roadshow. They had brought binders of materials, including what were perhaps the two most important documents, known as decks. One described the spin-off that Lehman referred to as REI Global. The other was labeled Commercial Real Estate Business Overview, in other words, the worst of the worst holdings, the toxic assets that no one knew precisely how to value, and that everyone was nonetheless certain that Lehman was overvaluing. Even now, Lehman seemed to be in denial. The decks revealed that it had marked down the value of its commercial real estate assets by an average of only 15%. Most Wall Street bankers had already assumed the reduction would be far greater. "Okay, let's just make sure you and I agree exactly on all of these issues and how they're financed," McDade said to Kirk. They reviewed each line in order, how the balance sheet was broken down by liabilities, their derivatives, receivables, payables, repo lines, and long-term debt. If they were confused about any given detail, McDade phoned Ian Lowett, who was a veritable financial encyclopedia. "He should be the one down here," McDade blurted during one of his explanations of an especially obtuse passage. As they completed their preparations, Steve Shaffron, Hank Paulson's top lieutenant, phoned and instructed the two men to go and meet their possible saviors. A security guard escorted them downstairs to the main dining room, where several dozen bankers waited. Wall Street's most elite firms were effectively about to go shopping in the equivalent of a government-sponsored Turkish bazaar. The Lehman executives were seated at a table in the farthest corner of the huge room, where everyone stopped to look, to gawk, in fact. "Do you know what this is like?" Kirk asked McDade when they were finally settled. "We're the kid with the dunce cap in the corner." McDade let out a big laugh, just as a group of bankers they did not know from Credit Suisse wandered over, flashing wide grins, and started eyeing them. "What's going on?" one of them asked. Kirk rolled his eyes in a way that clearly indicated, "Please do not mess with us." "What the fuck do you think is going on?" he replied. Before things could get too ugly, the cream of Wall Street suddenly appeared. Vikram Pandit, John Mack, John Thane, and Peter Krause came over to the table and got down to business. Mack, who had met McDade at his home over the summer when they had considered merging, struck a sympathetic note. "Oh, God, I feel awful for you guys. This is just terrible." Thane sat quietly sipping a coffee, with every reason to think, "This could be me." McDade pulled out his documents and began walking them through the numbers. As Krause began to question some of the assumptions, Pandit stopped him. "Okay, okay," he said impatiently, waving his hand in the air. "You have a homework assignment." he told the Lehman bankers. Give me a full business plan on how you would run this thing, so we can consider whether we're going to finance it. You have 2 hours to complete it. 5 minutes later, a security guard came over to McDade and Kirk and told them, We're going to take you up to another floor so you can work. The Fed had hoped to provide them with an actual conference room, but because there wasn't any space available, they were escorted to the Fed's medical center, where a makeshift office had been prepared. It was, if nothing else, all too apt a metaphor, as the Lehman executives immediately realized. Kirk looked at the defibrillator on the wall and deadpanned, Well, this is appropriate. We're clearly the heart attack victim. Greg Curl and Joe Price of Bank of America were on their way downtown with their lawyer, Ed Herlihy, for a 10 a.m. meeting with Paulson and Geithner. They had by now resolved not to pursue a deal with Lehman. Curl had already sent some of his people back to Charlotte. Before they arrived, Herlihy's cell rang. He could see from the caller ID that it was Fleming. For a moment, he hesitated answering. Before they had left, the group had discussed what to do if Fleming called again. Chris Flowers had advised Curl, Let's not waste another fucking minute on this until John Thane himself calls Ken Lewis and says the words out of his own mouth, I want to do this deal. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of bullshit. Exasperated, Herlihy finally answered the phone. We're going to make this happen, Fleming said excitedly. John says we should set it up. Herlihy had heard this before and had grown tired of the routine. Greg, I've said it once and I'll say it again. We're not doing this without being invited in. I'm actually in the car with Greg Curl now. I'll put him on. He'll tell you we're serious about that. Listen, we're interested, Curl said after being handed the phone. But we do need to hear from Thane directly on this. Okay, Fleming told him. I'll call you back. For all their interest in acquiring Merrill Lynch, Curl, Price, and Herlihy had reason to be wary of Fleming's overtures. The three men knew something that no one else knew, a bizarre turn of events that had never leaked out, and thank God for that, they thought to themselves, for it would have left them the laughingstocks of Wall Street. Ken Lewis had, in fact, already been through this dance with Merrill Lynch a year ago, almost to the week, with Stan O'Neill. No one outside of O'Neill and a handful of B of A executives even knew the talks had taken place, and not even Merrill's or Bank of America's board had been informed of them. On the last Sunday of September, O'Neill had driven down to Manhattan from his weekend home in Westchester to meet with Lewis at his plush corporate apartment in the new Time Warner Center. The meeting had been set up by Herlihy, who had acted as an intermediary. O'Neill showed up alone, though. Lewis had brought Curl with him. As a precondition of the meeting, O'Neill had indicated that he wanted $90 a share for Merrill Lynch, a substantial premium over its then stock price of slightly more than $70 a share. Lewis and Curl got right down to business, handing O'Neill a bound presentation of what a combination of Bank of America and Merrill would look like from a numbers and operational standpoint. As Lewis went through the proposal and was ready to start a discussion, O'Neill jumped out of his chair, excusing himself to go to the bathroom. After what felt like 20 minutes, as Lewis and Curl waited anxiously for him to return, they wavered between concern for O'Neill's health and frustration that he seemed to have vanished. Finally, O'Neill returned, as if nothing unusual had occurred. Lewis shrugged it off and continued going through the presentation. As he continued, O'Neill stopped him. Look, if we're going to do a deal, it's going to have to be at a reasonable premium, O'Neill said, raising the price he wanted for the firm to $100 a share. I've done some subsequent analysis and thought about it more, he said, explaining how he justified the higher price by a sum-of-the-parts analysis of Merrill's asset management, retail, and investment banking businesses. The number took Lewis aback. At first, he almost ended the conversation. But then he allowed that he would continue the talks, but suggested if O'Neill wanted more money, it would require more cuts. How much cost reduction do you have baked into the numbers that you have? O'Neill asked. Lewis's presentation projected $6 billion in cuts over 2 years, he replied. To O'Neill, that was a huge number, even for someone who had been famous for his own cost-cutting. and if he wanted $100 a share, it would be even more. O'Neill asked, "So, how would you see me fitting into this?" "Well, you'd be part of the management team, but I haven't really thought about a structure," Lewis told him. That answer clearly was unsatisfactory. If they were going to have to reduce costs by as much as Lewis was saying, O'Neill said, he'd want to be the president of the firm, so that at least somebody would be looking out for the Merrill employees. Lewis now became angry. "So what you're saying is, you want me to sell out my management team to get this deal done for your benefit?" For a moment, O'Neill only stared down at his feet, until finally saying, "I appreciate you spending the time. I appreciate the presentation and the thought that went into it. I've always thought that, on paper, that if Merrill were to do a strategic merger, you are the most compelling partner." As he turned to the door, O'Neill said, "I'll think about everything you said." Lewis never heard from him again. What he didn't know was that the next day O'Neill confided in Alberto Cribiori, a Merrill board member, that he had gone to see Lewis, and told him about the meeting. Cribiori, always a good proxy for the rest of the board, was clearly not receptive to the merger idea, quickly brushing it aside. In his heavy Italian accent, Cribiori said, "But Stan, Ken Lewis is an asshole!" The 16th floor of AIG was already a beehive of activity, with hundreds of bankers and lawyers roaming the floors, darting into the various rooms that had been set up to perform due diligence on different AIG assets up for sale. Before the high-end tire kickers arrived, Douglas Bronstein of J.P. Morgan, fresh off a conference call with Diamond, pulled Bob Willemstad aside to confide, "You need to think about more than the $20 or $30 billion we were talking about before, because Lehman could go bankrupt this weekend." "The market's going to be bad," Bronstein warned. "We should probably be thinking about $40 billion. Willemstad was flabbergasted. The challenge he faced had almost immediately doubled in size. A minute later, Sir Derek Maughan, the former head of Solomon Brothers, emerged from an elevator. Maughan, who was working for KKR, one of the bidders in the AIG fire sale, and Willemstad, had known each other well but hadn't been in touch for years. The last time they had seen each other was in 2004, when Maughan was being fired by Charles Prince, literally in Willemstad's presence. It was Maughan, too, who had snubbed Steve Black's wife on the dance floor more than a decade ago, resulting in a confrontation with Diamond, and his eventual ousting by Sandy Weill. And now, on a weekend when the entire financial system hung in the balance, Willemstad, Diamond, and Black were all looking to Maughan for help. "Ah," Willemstad thought as he greeted Maughan with a wide smile, "life is rich with irony." A few minutes earlier, David Bonderman of Texas Pacific Group, one of the wealthiest private equity moguls in the nation, had arrived with his own team. Bonderman, who was known for turnarounds, thanks to successful projects like fixing Continental Airlines, had also become increasingly leery of financial companies. He had acquired a $1.35 billion stake in Washington Mutual in April 2008 and watched his investment lose virtually all of its value in less than half a year. Willemstad was becoming increasingly anxious that all these bidders were there to suck AIG dry. Perhaps sensing Willemstad's anxiety, Dr. Paul Achleitner, a board member of the insurance giant Allianz, who had cut short his vacation in Mallorca, Spain, to fly in for the diligence session, approached him. "Can I see you privately?" he asked. "Sure," Willemstad replied. Achleitner had been invited to the diligence session by Chris Flowers, who had chartered a plane to fetch Achleitner and bring him across the Atlantic. Willemstad and Achleitner found a quiet corner. "I want you to know that I'm not here with all these vultures," Achleitner said, pointing at the scrum of private equity investors swirling about. "I'm here as Allianz. If we're going to invest, we might invest alongside them, but we're going to make our own decision." "Thank you, I appreciate that," Willemstad said, before returning to the vultures. Willemstad and the AIG team were quickly having a difficult time keeping track of everyone in the growing crowd and, as the weekend wore on, whom they actually represented. When Christopher A. Cole from Goldman Sachs appeared with a small army of bankers, John Studzinski, AIG's banker from Blackstone, became alarmed. Goldman? Who invited them? "Who are you working for?" Studzinski asked Cole. At first, Cole seemed oddly reticent to say. "Well," he said, "we have several clients here." Studzinski just stared at him, hoping to hear more. As they spoke, Richard Friedman, who ran Goldman Sachs' private investment business, walked by, which did not go unnoticed by everyone else in the room. Was Goldman actually there for itself? "We're here," Cole started speaking again, "working with Alliance, AXA, and Goldman Sachs Capital Partners." It was all so confusing and conflicted. Skeptical about the answers he was getting, and perhaps a bit paranoid, Studzinski raced up to the senior security guard on the 18th floor, Nathan T. Harrison. "Listen," he told him, "I want you to watch all these people like a hawk. If you see anything untoward, anything at all, people walking around the wrong floors, whatever, come find me immediately." Without a minute to spare, the Bank of America team, which included Greg Curl, Joe Price, and Ed Herlihy, marched into the Fed building for their 10:30 a.m. meeting with Paulson and Geithner. Christopher Flowers had raced over on foot from AIG, two blocks away. As they waited in a conference room outside Geithner's office, Curl recounted to the group how Fold had been phoning Lewis's home all night. "Dick, what an asshole," Flowers said dismissively. As Paulson, Geithner, and Dan Jester entered the room, the mood quickly turned chilly. Paulson hated Flowers, and the antipathy was mutual. They had been feuding for years, ever since Paulson passed over Flowers for the top job of running Goldman's investment banking division, back when the firm was planning to go public. Flowers, who was given to telling his peers that Paulson was an idiot, quickly left the firm. Paulson told him that his decision to quit, coming as it did at the critical time of the IPO, was a disgrace. Flowers was bought out of the partnership ahead of the offering, but when the IPO was canceled, he made overtures about trying to return to the firm. That conversation had ended in a near shouting match. Trying to break the tension, Geithner now asked, "So what's the latest?" Curl indicated in no uncertain terms that B of A was no longer interested in buying Lehman Brothers, unless the government was prepared to help even more than they had asked for the day before. He said that they had identified at least $70 billion in problem assets that Bank of America would need guaranteed. The figure had grown from the $40 billion of a day earlier, and that it might be even larger. Given that, they were going to put their pencils down unless Paulson was willing to step up. Curl also said that he was concerned that Fold was still seeking a premium for the stock. "We think that's bullshit," Flowers remarked. "You know, no one cares what they think." "Don't worry about what they think," Paulson told him. "At this point, it doesn't matter what Dick Fold thinks." In the middle of the meeting, Herlihy's cell phone began ringing, and he saw that it was Fleming. After ignoring his first two calls, Herlihy whispered to Curl that it was Fleming, and excused himself from the meeting. "What's up?" Herlihy asked impatiently. "Okay, he'll do the meeting at 2:30 p.m., Fleming exclaimed. "Well, can you get Thane to call Lewis?" Herlihy asked. "Not now," Fleming said. "Thane can't speak to him because he's in a meeting with Paulson." Herlihy rolled his eyes. "No, he's not, Greg. I'm in a meeting at the Fed with Paulson. I just stepped out of the room and can see him. He's down the hall from me." Herlihy was growing increasingly concerned that Fleming didn't have Thane's blessing and repeated, "Listen, this isn't going to work. He's got to call. If I can step out to take your call, he can step out and call Lewis." "He's going to be there, I promise. I'm not risking my reputation by having Lewis fly up here and go to an empty meeting," Fleming insisted. "He's got to make the call," Herlihy insisted again. By the time Herlihy stepped back into the room, it was clear that the meeting was winding down, and while the government was still refusing to become involved, Paulson was trying to keep Bank of America from dropping out altogether. As everyone stood up to leave, Chris Flowers pulled Paulson aside and said, "I've got to talk to you about AIG." He paused to make certain they weren't being overheard and continued, I've been over there working with them, and it's just remarkable what we found." He took out the same piece of paper that had been handed out the day before, showing the firm's cash outflows, and how by Wednesday it would be out of money. "Here's how big the hole is," Flowers said, pointing to the negative $5 billion cash balance coming due that next week. "AIG is just totally out of control. They're incompetent." Flowers offered to come back to the Fed with Willemstad to go over the numbers in more detail, and while Paulson was shocked at the numbers, he tried not to give Flowers the satisfaction of knowing how unnerved he was. When Flowers walked out of the meeting and rejoined the Bank of America team in the hallway, he smugly told them, "They're not on top of it." As Paulson, Geithner, and Jester reassembled in Geithner's office, Jester stressed that they had to somehow keep Bank of America warm so that it remained in the auction. And if Bank of America had dropped out, it had to be kept quiet, especially from Barclays. Paulson, however, was focused on the AIG document that he had just seen, doing the math in his head. "It's much worse than I thought," he finally said. "These guys are in deep doo-doo." Geithner reached Willemstad on speakerphone and told him that they had just met with Chris Flowers, who had walked them through the numbers. "He's looking at buying some assets, putting together a deal," Willemstad responded. And for a moment, the confused government officials all looked at one another. Wasn't Flowers advising AIG? But then Jester smiled knowingly at Paulson. This was classic Flowers, playing both sides. It quickly became evident to everyone that Flowers was likely trying to tee up a deal for his buyout shop with government assistance. "He's frankly a troublemaker," Paulson exclaimed. "He doesn't want to save this country." The discussion returned to the numbers, and Willemstad explained that they had teams of bidders at his office and were hoping to sell enough assets over the weekend to cover the pending shortfall. Geithner suggested Willemstad come over later that day to review the firm's books, and so that they could get a better handle on what its plans were. "Okay," Willemstad said. With a laugh, he added, "I won't be bringing Flowers." Downstairs, the CEOs were now summoned from the dining room to the conference room to deliver a progress report to Paulson and Geithner. Each of the groups offered up what they had accomplished, which amounted to very little. Part of the problem was that there was still huge disagreement over what Lehman's assets were actually worth, especially its notorious commercial real estate assets. While Lehman had been valuing the portfolio at $41 billion, consisting of $32.6 billion in loans and $8.4 billion in investments, everyone knew it was worth far less. But how much less? One set of estimates making the rounds was a spreadsheet called Blue Write-Downs that cut the estimated value of Lehman's commercial real estate loans by about one quarter, to less than $24 billion. Others thought the situation was much worse. A handwritten sheet with more estimations making the rounds had the numbers 17 to 20, less than half the estimated value. The story was much the same with residential mortgages, which Lehman had estimated at $17.2 billion. While the blue spreadsheet placed the value at about $14 billion, others in the room put the real value at closer to $9.2 billion, or roughly half. But Pandit had another issue to raise. He wanted to talk again about AIG, and then he added, "What about Merrill?" It made for an awkward moment, as John Thane was only seats away. "You guys get this done for me, and I'll make sure I can take care of AIG and Merrill," Paulson replied. "I'm a little uncomfortable talking about Merrill Lynch with John in the room." Harvey Miller, Lehman's bankruptcy lawyer, had just had a terrible meeting with representatives of the New York Fed. He couldn't answer any of their questions, and frankly, he was embarrassed at having continually to resort to the same answer. "We don't have access to information. Everybody at Lehman is either working on Bank of America or Barclays." After they left, Miller complained to his colleague, Lori Fife. That was bullshit. Miller had dealt with tough clients before. Bankruptcy was always a parlous transaction. But he had never been shut out like this. When he called Steve Birkenfeld, Lehman's general counsel, to complain, Birkenfeld tried to explain why the information had not been as forthcoming as he had hoped. The problem is that many of our financial team have gone downtown to give an update to the Fed.
I see, replied Miller frostily.
And what is the latest with Barclays?
We're still hopeful, but there's not much new to report at this moment.
And with B of A?
Birkenfeld paused before answering, They've gone radio silent.
That didn't sound very encouraging to Miller, who had developed a keen ear for detecting a tone that indicated the end was near. His team of lawyers had been operating on the assumption that the bankruptcy work was a contingency. No one was expecting Lehman to have to make a filing immediately. But as the clouds over the firm grew darker, Miller decided to move forward. He told Fife that if Lehman were to need to file for bankruptcy, it would take them at least 2 weeks to get the paperwork in order. They might as well begin now. Just after noon, he sent out an email to a handful of colleagues with an apocalyptic subject line. Urgent, codename Equinox, have desperate need for help on an emergency situation. Thane was in the middle of a conversation strategizing with Peter Krause when Fleming called.
I set it up, Fleming told him excitedly. You'll meet with Lewis this afternoon.
Thane knew that the meeting was a good idea, but there was one complication. Paulson's not going to like this, he warned Fleming. A merger, he thought, would be a death sentence for Lehman, as he'd have stolen Lehman's sole potential savior. He didn't know that Bank of America had dropped its bid for Lehman.
Paulson's constituency is the taxpayer, Fleming responded. Ours is Merrill Lynch shareholders. Paulson has the ability to step in. We're going to have to listen to him, but we don't have to anticipate that. He may not like it, but unless he tells us we can't do it, if we think this is in the best interest of Merrill Lynch's shareholders, we need to do it.
Thane still hesitated, wanting to make certain that he wasn't putting the company into play.
I've set the meeting for 2:30 p.m., Fleming pressed, and then carefully added,
But you have to call Ken first.
Why? Thane asked, perplexed at the request.
Because he wants to hear your voice, Fleming answered.
What do you mean?
I don't know. Just tell him the weather is nice in New York and you're looking forward to seeing him.
I don't understand why I need to make the call, Thane persisted.
John, you just have to call him.
You're getting on my nerves, Thane said, annoyance straining his voice.
You know what? That's probably going to happen again this weekend, Fleming said, raising his own voice to his boss for the first time. But call the guy. He's not going to fly until you call him.
Okay, Thane agreed. They decided that they'd both meet at Merrill's Midtown office in 30 minutes to plan for the meeting. Soon after Thane hung up with Fleming, John Mack walked over to him.
We should talk, Mack said quietly.
He didn't have to elaborate. The phrase was accepted code for, we should talk about doing a deal together.
You're right, Thane said, and they agreed to organize a meeting later that day. It was becoming a busy day.
On the fourth floor of the Fed, Bob Diamond of Barclays was tapping his foot impatiently. For most of the morning, it seemed to him that Lehman and the government were exclusively focused on Bank of America. He had come to suspect that he was being used, that he was the government's stalking horse, so that they could coax out a higher bid for Lehman from Bank of America. But then, just past 2 p.m., Diamond had an indication that his bid might be taken seriously when someone at the Fed taped a piece of paper on Barclays' conference room door that said, Bidder. The Fed's kitchen staff had also finally showed up with food, all small gestures, but encouraging signals nonetheless. Still, Diamond knew he had a big problem to deal with before a Lehman deal could take place, a problem that he had yet to share with Paulson or anyone in the U.S. government. His general counsel in London, Mark Harding, had informed him on an internal conference call that morning that if Barclays were to announce plans to acquire Lehman, the deal would require a shareholder vote, a vote that might take as long as 30 to 60 days to complete. That meant that it would be critical that Barclays find a way to guarantee Lehman's trading from the time they signed the deal until it was approved by its shareholders, or the acquisition would be worthless. Without the guarantee, Lehman's trading partners would stop doing business with it, swiftly draining its resources and destroying any value for Barclays. This was about confidence,
Counterparties needed to know that there was someone standing behind Lehman in the same way that J.P. Morgan had stepped to the plate for Bear Stearns and guaranteed all of its trades even before the deal closed. The problem was that legally, Barclays could not guarantee any more than about $3.5 billion of Lehman's trades without seeking permission from shareholders first, a process that could take as long as completing the deal. Paulson and Geithner had repeatedly told Diamond in no uncertain terms that the U.S. government was not going to help, but he hadn't been able to determine if that was just a negotiating stance. As for the British government, there was no mystery there to him. It was perfectly clear that it wouldn't get involved. What Barclays needed was a partner, a big, rich one, and it was a matter that Diamond knew he had to discuss with his brain trust, which was led by Archibald Cox, Jr., Barclays' capital chairman, and the son of the Watergate prosecutor, Rich Ricci, the firm's COO, and Jerry Delmizier, Barclays Capital's co-president. Diamond had also hired his own outside advisor, Michael Klein, a smart former senior banker at Citigroup. Klein had resigned from Citigroup months earlier, rather than be marginalized by Pandit's new team, but he was still a hot commodity. To keep him from going to work for a competitor, Citigroup had agreed to pay him out $28 million in deferred compensation that he would have lost by leaving. In exchange, he had to stay on the beach for an entire year. Diamond, convinced he needed Klein on his side, had called Pandit earlier in the week to get his on-the-beach status temporarily suspended so that he could work for Barclays on an emergency basis. As they began brainstorming about the trading guarantee problem, Klein asked aloud, "Who could possibly do this? This is the kind of thing that a year ago you'd go to AIG, and they would have wrapped this for you, right?" Delmizier asked. That clearly was no longer possible, and Klein offered, "What about Buffett?" "Yeah, but Buffett only does deals if it's a fantastic deal for Buffett," Delmizier pointed out. Klein had done some deals with the Omaha Oracle when he was at Citigroup and had all his phone numbers. He called and found Buffett at the Fairmont Hotel McDonald in Edmonton, Alberta, as he and his second wife, Astrid Manx, were about to leave for a gala, unbeknownst to them, as the surprise guests. Klein put him on speakerphone with Diamond and his team. Delmizier began to explain to Buffett why the guarantee was so important. If Lehman trades dollars for yen with somebody, that bank needs to know that Lehman is going to deliver the dollars before they deliver the yen, he told Buffett. If there are worries that they're going to be able to settle that trade, the whole thing is going to unravel. Buffett understood what was at stake, but couldn't fathom guaranteeing Lehman's books for up to 2 months. But wanting to be polite, he suggested, "If you fax me something written out about it, when I get back, I'll be glad to read it." As he shut his cell phone and strolled to his car on the way to the gala, Buffett remembered the last time he had received a call like this. What a mess that turned out to be. In 1998, the week before the rescue of Long-Term Capital, John Corzine of Goldman Sachs called, asking if he'd consider joining a group interested in buying the giant troubled hedge fund. Buffett was about to leave on a trip to Alaska with Bill and Melinda Gates, so he asked Corzine to send him some information on that deal. Then he ended up spending a day trying in vain to get his satellite phone to connect while he viewed grizzly bears in Pack Creek. He tried to orchestrate a deal between himself, Goldman, and AIG, but failed. It was a big waste of time and energy. Maybe he had to stop being so polite to these Wall Street boys. Downstairs at the New York Fed, the CEOs and their underlings had all begun milling around the lunch buffet tables. Despite the grave assignment they'd been given, there was little they could actually accomplish on the spot. Not only did they not have computers with them, but the people with any real expertise in analyzing balance sheets and assets were either with the Lehman team upstairs or back at their offices, poring over volumes of spreadsheets. In one corner, a number of executives, trying to pass the time, were doing vicious imitations of Paulson, Geithner, and Cox. One banker muttered, adopting Paulson's stammer. "Work harder, get smarter," another shouted, mocking Geithner's Boy Scoutish exhortations. A third did his best impression of Christopher Cox, whom they were all convinced had little understanding of high finance. 2 plus 2? Could I have a calculator? In another corner, Colm Kelleher, Morgan's CFO, had begun playing Brick Breaker on his BlackBerry, and soon an unofficial tournament was underway, with everyone competitively comparing scores. After lunch, they were all summoned back into the main conference room, where John Thane's absence did not go unnoticed. If there was one topic besides Lehman's future on the